Okay, a few Rashis for Parshas Ve'eschanan. It may sound quieter than it normally does. The Zman has ended. Baruch Hashem, we learn until Tisha B'Av, to Erev Tisha B'Av, obviously. So it's a big schus to be able to keep in the base matters and keep trying to send Torah from the base matters. But now that I'm outside of the base matters, I'll try. No promises. I'll be in transit next week. But just to keep some of the Torah opportunities available. During the summer months, summer weeks until Elul begins in 3 weeks in Mirtz Hashem. So, a couple of interesting Rashis from Parshas Eschanan, chock full of interesting Rashis. I'll refer, if you're listening to this year, to a shiur I prepared a few days ago on the Rashis of the section of Eschanan that we read on Tisha B'Av, Kisa Libanim Uvenei Vanim, that can be found on YU Torah or my Facebook and Twitter pages as advertised as 10 minutes of Rashi for Tisha B'Av. But it's also for Rosh Chana now that it's post-Tisha B'Av. Unfortunately, we still don't have the Beis HaMikdash. So now it can revert to being Rashis about Rosh Chana. But some new Rashis, in case you heard that shiur already, and some general Rashis that don't apply specifically to Tisha B'Av. The very beginning of Rosh Chana, which is a very diverse, almost rambling monologue of Moshe, that's more of a generalized statement. That's why we employ that pasuk in so many different contexts, primarily in Kriya Satara. And then Moshe says, so he's starting almost a new chapter. One can say this is the opening, the beginning, after he finishes reporting the Yidavin HaKadosh Baruch Hu to no avail. And he says, you should watch the Torah, you should preserve the Torah. This is your badge of honor. This is your badge of intellectual honor in the eyes of all the nations. They will be amazed and marvel at how smart we are. And they'll also be able to translate this, that we are smart because we're close to Hashem. Not just that our engagement in Torah mitzvahs reflects our relationship with Hashem, but it also reflects the mishpatim tzadikim, the rational, moral, enhancing, enriching mitzvahs. So there are three psukim in which Moshe Rabbeinu says that they will notice that you are smart, chachmaschem, and they will translate what they notice, that impression, into Gai Gadol Ashelo Elokim Krovim Elav. They'll translate that, well, you're smart because you're close to Hashem, and you're smart and great because these mitzvahs themselves make sense. So, as it were, even if they were to detach it from the theological component and the closest to Hashem, let's say for argument's sake, Hashem was distant from us, but this is still the Chas Hashem, this is still the code that He gave us, and this is a code by which we live our lives, and they are Chukim and Mishpatim. So this is the second part of the recording. I apologize for interrupting in the middle. My son called. He's overseas. I wanted to speak with him and wish him a good Shabbos. One of the delights of being out of yeshiva is that you don't have your free time. It's always a little bit here, a little bit there. So, getting back to the Rashi. Rashi doesn't add that much. Just to summarize, it's a three-pasuk section. This is how you will be seen in the eyes of the nation. L'nei kol amim. Torah will make you seem wise and smart. Chachmaschem uvinaschem. Pasuk number two, they'll be able to trace it to your relationship with Hashem. Pasuk number three, even without tracing it to your relationship with Hashem, they'll be just marveling at the inner logic and the richness that Torah life provides. The Shaloh Chukim Mishpatim Tzadikim. It's moral, it's right, it's just. Then the fourth pasuk, Rachi Shamar Lecha Oshmar Navshcha Meod, Pen Tishkach Hesed Devarim. So keep in mind that many Rishonim see this as a separate pasuk, imposing an Isser either to forget Torah, the famous mission Perkei Avos, that a person who forgets his Torah is mischayev benafsho, based on this pasuk, pentishkach es hadevarim asherehu enecha, v'adatam levonecha v'levnei vonecha. The Ramban, in his Sefer HaMitzvos, argues with the Rambam. He lists this as an iser to forget Har Sinai and the theology or theological component of Har Sinai. But Rashi, interestingly enough, says that if you don't forget the Torah, if you adhere to this fourth pasuk prohibition, pentishkach es hadevarim, then you will be continued to be viewed as smart and wise because you'll continue on a path of Torah and mitzvahs. So this is a four-pasuk section about Torah and how it frames us in the eyes of the other nations. And Rashi doesn't add that much. Sometimes I'll just read a Rashi and he doesn't add that much, but just seeing Rashi comment on it makes me feel that Rashi is, so to speak, highlighting these psukim, that we should think about them more, even if he doesn't add any new information. To me, at least, it doesn't seem like he adds new information. But it got me thinking, and that's part of Rashi's job, is to get you and me thinking. It got me thinking, well, has this been true throughout our history? And one way to answer that question is with a resounding no. That they never saw Torah, and they never saw us as wise because of our Torah study and our mitzvah performance. And this is just Moshe speaking about the ideal. Ideally, when you're in your land, and people are able to appreciate Hashem's presence through your Torah lifestyle, then they'll also accredit you or acknowledge you as being wise and smart and be able to see through your Torah lifestyle. And sadly, for the last 2,000 years, we haven't, and therefore we haven't really been able to be viewed that way through our Torah and mitzvot lifestyle. Of course, I don't think that's the read. If you listen to my series on Gullus, which I gave, just to summarize it in one sentence, Gullus isn't a break in Jewish history. Gullus is a shift in Jewish history where the terms of Jewish identity and our role in the world remain the same, but the conditions are different, and the conditions elicit hostility and anger, anti-Semitism, suffering, etc. So how has Torah, over the last 2,000 years, not just in the golden age of Jewish universalism, but in the last 2,000 years, has this pasuk been true? So it's interesting, because partially yes, partially no, but even the no is intriguing. On the one hand, Jews were always viewed as smart. That's a trope that people employ for anti-Semitic purposes, but it just happens to be true. If you spend your whole day analyzing texts, and you spend your whole day analyzing intricate logical structures about Torah Sheba'al Peh, and every Jew has some entry into Torah, and that's why Jews always had a literacy rate that far, far surpassed. Baruch Hashem, in the modern world, most of the world is literate, most of the educated world. But it wasn't always true, and Jews were always exponentially more literate than their peers. So that trope that Jews are smarter people happens to be true because they happen to be much more literate than the average citizen with whom they shared a country or a society. So it was true that Jews were seen as smarter, as wiser. That was one of our survival skills in Gullus, that we were needed and we were coveted, even though we were hated, and that put many empires into a bind. Should they take the Jews? Should they not take the Jews? I don't know the exact, I'm not a historian, I'm not a professional historian, but the reigning Suleiman, I think his name is actually Suleiman, who was the vizier or the emperor of Turkey, when noting that the Jews were expelled from Spain, said, "That's strange. I thought Ferdinand was a smart king. Why would you divest yourself of your most valuable resources, namely the Jews?" And he gladly welcomed the Jews, even, little known historical fact, sending ships in 1492 to the Spanish port of Malaga to pick up Jews and transport them. He provided the transport device and mechanisms because he so welcomed the Jews into his society. Now, so Jews were always seen as smart. Now, whether that was traced to their learning Torah, as the pasuk says, that by studying Torah, chachmaschem uvinaschem, or the lifestyle of mitzvos, or they were thought it was something else, something genetic, something cultural. But that pasuk, ki hi chachmaschem uvinaschem le'nei ha'amim, was definitely true to a point. On the other hand, what about Torah? Was Torah seen as the source of wisdom? Right? Jews were seen as smart. It could have been attributed to any sort of cultural or natural factors, but was it the Torah that was seen as chachmaschem uvinaschem? So there, it's a bit of a mixed record. On the one hand, Torah itself, Shebichsav, was certainly seen that way, and I keep trying to recast Hanukkah not as an isolated attack, but as a broader multi-century interaction between the Greeks and the Jews, and part of that interaction were the Greeks desiring the people of Yefes, the children of Yefes, realizing that the road to truth didn't just lie through the human mind and through the human intellect, which was developing in Athens, but through the prophetic truths that were handed down in Yerushalayim. And the people of Shame were the address. Shame, that is S-H-A-M-E, but the children of Shame, us, possessed these truths. And Athens knew they had to travel to Yerushalayim to acquire these truths. Now, that was a multi-century interaction, part of which was this clash of two cultures. But part of it was translating Torah into Greek, which is a sad day in many respects, and not a sad day in other respects. I talked about that also in my series. And part of it was Alexander the Great coming to Yerushalayim. And part of it is in the aftermath of Hanukkah, many Jews were Hellenized, but many Greeks were Judaicized. Now, do they become Gerim? Do they ultimately become Christians? That's an interesting question, but they certainly moved away from the world of paganism. So, Torah Shebichsav was always seen, and of course, the two major monotheistic religions adopted the Bible as their source and basic moral and theological points, which luckily have carried over to those religions, corrupt though they may be, but they're superior to the ancient world of paganism and black magic. Now, Torah Sheba'al Peh, that's already a different issue. Torah Sheba'al Peh was always under attack. We just spoke yesterday during Tisha B'Av about the burning of the Shasim in Paris in the 13th century, Shali Sarufa Ba'esh, the Maharami Ruttenberg's Kina, witnessing the Shasim being burnt, the attacks on Torah Sheba'al Peh, the disputation in Barcelona. So at least on the surface, this was a system and a book that was mocked. Now, it's anyone's guess as to what type of deeper psychological insecurity religions may have felt recognizing the richness and the vastness of Torah Sheba'al Peh, and did that insecurity when thinking about Torah Sheba'al Peh create a necessity to belittle and to mock? That's hard to know. It's hard to play pop psychology with hundreds of years of Christian and to a lesser degree Muslim discrimination against the Jews and attacks on Torah Sheba'al Peh. But it's just interesting to use this pasuk as a prism to think about, did it come true? Did the nations really see us as chachmaschem uvinaschem v'nei goyim? In some ways, it was definitely true about the Jews. It was definitely true about Torah Shebichsav. I'm not sure if it was true about Torah Sheba'al Peh until the modern era. It is interesting to notice the rising popularity of Torah Sheba'al Peh and the reason that certain nations are starting to read Torah Sheba'al Peh, especially in the Far East, which to me is very intriguing because those are the long-lost, presumably the long-lost descendants of Keturah, of Abraham's children later in his life, in South Korea and now in China, I think in Japan, maybe not in China, there's a budding interest in Talmud because they want to be smart like the Jews. And they realize that our secret to wisdom and to intellect is through Talmud. Again, many people listening to this, I don't know where you're listening, but you may not be aware. In America, you're probably aware. In Israel, you're probably aware. Of course, in other communities, you may not be aware of the droves and droves and droves of yeshiva bachrim who spend years in yeshiva, and typically in more yeshivish environments, and they don't go to university, and they're able to very quickly, through various means and devices, segue into law school, segue into different graduate programs, and their experiences in Torah Sheba'al Peh equip them with the analytical skills. I certainly found it that way, that my years in yeshiva equipped me with the analytical skills. I remember I tried different professions and dabbled in this and dabbled in that, and even without the requisite training that I didn't have, I wasn't as versed, I'm not going to get into the details, I found myself very well positioned to be involved in various fields because of my Talmudic background. Okay, so that's one Rashi. Another interesting Rashi after this very, very long description about the fears he harbors, about their entry into Eretz Yisrael, reviewing what happened in Har Sinai, warning them two times and three times against Avodah Zarah, then there's a break in the action. It's Shlishi. It's a very, very abrupt break. Az, Yavdil Moshe, Shalosh Harim Be'eva Haradein, Mizruch HaShemesh. Moshe, in the middle of everything, dedicates or designates three Ari Miklat Neveh Har Yarden. Again, Rashi notes the obvious, but I think here he adds a little bit. What does Rashi say? Nasan Lev Lios Chared L'davar Sheyavdila. Very interesting. Rashi's commenting on the words Az. Az is always something more emotional. Az Yashir Moshe, their hearts brought them to sing. So Az is captures a moment rather than Vayavdil Moshe, which would be an action. Us, which seems to be redundant because any action takes place at that moment. So at that moment, he could have just said, Vayavdil. So us, Rashi says, Nasan Lev, or Nosin Lev, Lios Chari, quotes the Gemara in Makos, I'm sorry, quotes the Gemara in Makos, yeah. Lios Chari Ledavar Sheavdilim. He started to be attendant and concerned and not worried, but just determined. Chared is a little bit of worry that shows conviction, determination, commitment. Even though these three cities that he designated in Chutz La'aretz had no validity, had no, they weren't activated to receive negligent murderers. Amar Moshe, mitzvah she'afshe l'kayma akamenu. I have a mitzvah on my hand. I don't want to forgo it, even though the effect of the mitzvah won't be felt until the parallel cities are designated in Eretz Yisrael. So there's some very interesting highlights to this Rashi. The obvious one is the interplay between big ideas, theology, ideology, mitzvos, Har Sinai, and just not the concept of mitzvos, but just executing mitzvos. Some have a very easy time with the big ideas of religion, harder time with the day-to-day execution. And again, this isn't Moshe warning about the big ones, the Isra of Avodah Zarah, the Isra of Tzicha, the 10 of the Aseret HaDibros making a takana, but it's something very, very micro, very minute. It's a drill down. It's a subset of a subset of a subset of a category of the general laws of Ritzicha and of Ritzicha Bishogeg on intentional murder and what types of Ir Miklat and Ir Miklat in Eva HaYardin. But Moshe's capacity, hopefully our capacity, to combine the ideas of Judaism with the practices of Judaism. And sometimes people are more attracted to the ideas because they're general, they don't demand commitment and obedience, they're broad, they attach themselves to our broad-minded thinking, which we like to associate with religion, and sometimes we're less attentive. So this sandwiching, or this natural seamlessness between big ideas and mitzvos. Second part is this almost worry. Rashi says that Moshe is a little bit worried that the clock will run out on him. So as if he's giving his shiur, listening to his monologue, his soliloquy about life in Israel, about life after he passes, and all of a sudden, like something jumps into his mind, says, wait a second, this day is going to end very, really quickly. Moshe does a lot of talking, and by the time this day ends, this is the last day of Moshe's life, I'm going to pass, and I won't have fulfilled this mitzvah, someone else will fulfill it. So as if, those of you who have yeshiva background, osek mitzvah, eino patur min mitzvah. He has the ability just to exonerate himself and excuse and exempt himself because he's giving this long musar shmuz. Wait a second. What's the purpose of my musar shmuz if I pass this mitzvah? So as if he has a time clock or a clock winding down, he feels this anxiety. And anxiety in religion is healthy. Well, anxiety probably isn't healthy. Commitment, duty, responsibility, obligation, a bit of worry. Once it translates into anxiety and into depression and into neurosis, that's the ugly part of religious duty, or the unhealthy part. And I work very hard with the students to find that balance, right? Religion shouldn't be apathetic. Religion shouldn't be indifferent. Religion shouldn't be casual. I get the mitzvah, I don't get the mitzvah. It should be driven by some interest that borders on worry, at least Moshe's last day of his life. Will he fulfill this? Basically, this is the last mitzvah that Moshe fulfills. I mean, probably writing a Sefer Torah happens afterwards, but it's one of the final mitzvahs. I remember once we were learning Yesh Nochalin with Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, which is the eighth parak of Bava Basra. And parak Yesh Nochalin describes a circumvention of the laws of Yerusha, which most people employ today. It's called Mechalek Nechasav. You write a contract that takes place a second before you pass, and you redistribute your possessions based on what we would call more modern egalitarian interests rather than the Torah's original interests. Basically, you give an equal portion to your daughters, and you don't give extra to your Bechor, because in our current context, this is a Bechor speaking, that doesn't seem fair to the entire family. So the Bechor and everyone else get the same amount, and the women get theirs, and basically everyone gets an equal share. And you avoid a lot of fighting, and this is obviously highly, highly recommended. So we asked Rav Lichtenstein, would he do that? And he showed some discomfort, and he said, no, he would not. He would want the final mitzvah of his life, the mitzvah of Yerusha, to happen naturally, naturally meaning halachically, and then he would hope that his children, after the Yerusha, flows in its halachic format, basically the Bechor gets twice and the women don't get, he would hope that his children were then redistributed fairly just to avoid any fighting and to avoid, and of course you need a very strong family unit in order to depend on that. I never asked what happened, but it always struck me as that desire to be mekayim the last mitzvah of your life, one of the last mitzvahs of your life, properly, rather than finding a loophole and circumventing it. So it's not just that Moshe shows the ability to be ideological and broad and give a musar shmuz, but also drill down to the details of the mitzvah. But the word "us" suggests at that moment, Moshe caught himself and he said, I can't let this mitzvah slip by. And the third feature of this Rashi is, and Rashi of course highlights this based on Gemara Makos, is this is a mitzvah which will have no impact until Moshe is long past this world. Because his three Ari Miklat in the west, in the east bank of the Jordan, will not have halachic capacity until the corresponding three cities are designated in the regular Eretz Yisrael, what we call the West Bank of the Jordan, or Eretz Yisrael proper. And there's a heroism here that a mitzvah can only be gauged by its impact. Any mitzvah is a fulfillment of the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is internally sufficient, internally relevant. Very often, we gauge the value of religious activity based on the broader social impact, or we gauge relevancy, and we fail to realize that every act of Torah, certainly Torah, because Torah is an internal, insular world, which is eternal, far beyond this world, but for that matter, every mitzvah performance has relevance and has impact. Now, I know this is part of the larger conversation as to where you draw the balance at a personal level between internal religious experience, which is rich and deep and bridges your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and how much you look outward to create bridges and social value, and we say social impact. Of course, at a collective level, this is always the conversation between, you know, they just wanted to pass a law in Israel that religious study is considered national service, and every single religious Jew must agree with that statement. I don't care if you're Haredi or not Haredi. Of course, religious study is a national service. And of course, the reason we are protected is because we study Torah. And of course, if someone learns seriously, they're serving our people and bringing Hashem into our world and into our state. Those who, like myself, teach in a Hasidic yeshiva believe that under the current conditions, the superior model is a blend of the two, given all the pros and cons of that model. And other people feel that Torah excellence cannot be generated through a blend. And of course they're right, because you can't create, it's just a question of hours. In the end of the day, Torah is a question of hours. And the more hours, the more excellence in Torah. It's not just the hours, also the culture. Whatever, I don't want to get into that conversation. But sometimes I hear people who are not part of the Haredi world questioning that. And you can't, again, I call this the unintended appropriation of truths. Haredi world unintentionally, but once they say it, people who disagree with their view tend to disagree with that fundamental concept. We don't disagree about the fundamentals. We have a slight disagreement about the application of those fundamentals. In any event, Moshe performs a mitzvah that seems to have no social impact. But of course, being that it's a fulfillment of Hashem's commandment, it has all the impact in the world. So, when I'm tired, I normally rant, so I apologize for the rant. I wanted to speak about a third Rashi, but I'm a little bit busy today also. So just to summarize, two Rashis. One Rashi about Torah casting us as wise in the eyes of the nations, either as people or the Torah itself is our source of wisdom. And the second Rashi, Moshe designating three cities, number one, being able to drill down to mitzvahs, not just remain, not just deliver an ideological sermon. Number two, this uz, Rashi says, at that moment, there was something in his heart. Compare the word uz here to the word uz yashir. There's something in his heart that, in their heart, that moved them to sing poetry, and there's something in Moshe's heart that moved them to worry. And the third aspect is that Moshe recognizes this mitzvah will have no social impact, but is still fulfilling Hashem's, something very romantic about Moshe leaving this earth and wanting to fulfill Hashem's commandments, even if they won't have any social influence. Shabbat Shalom.